Welcome, folks, to the Slowpokes podcast. We play great games just a little bit late. I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
Today, we are finishing a era here on the Slowpokes podcast.
As you can hear, the herald has been sounded. The people are arrayed.
The seventh seal has been broken.
Yes. The people are arrayed
the horsemen ride.
The king himself kneels towards the majesty of this very auspicious event. Used fancy word.
Yeah, so season three, and being season three, means we have done our obligatory Mass Effect.
Yes!
And season three, Mass Effect 3, Mass Effect 3!
Mass Effect 3! We just played Mass Effect 3. Well, I just played Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, I had a responsible recording schedule. I finished this a couple of days before we sat down. John, when did you finish Mass Effect 3?
In my true Slowpoke fashion, I finished the game today. The day of recording.
I walked in the door and he came out of his study and said, just finished it.
I don't want to portray anything about myself, but if we looked at the stats, I think the number's above 50. If we're talking about games I finished on the day. For someone who's very organized, I am very unorganized.
Yeah, see, I just don't have any social obligations, really.
You should get rid of those. They're terrible. I should do that.
The point is, we both have finished Mass Effect 3. Yes. John, we should start with our expectations, I think, because more so than any other series, I mean, any other game we've covered on the show, we've really built to this one. Like, we've done all of them through, and it's your first time playing any of the series for the show.
Like, I hardly believe we're here. I still remember the times when I failed to finish Mass Effect 1 and was always like, I'll never get to it. But now we're here at the pinnacle. A lot of the things that I expected to find about the Mass Effect series was for the first one to be a really great game, for the second one to be like the peak of it, and for the third one to be kind of marred, and mostly by the ending. I think it might be, as we sort of talk about more, it might be a lot of negativity about the ending and not much about the rest of the game, but I was expecting it to be the worst one.
I think that's interesting, because when we talk about, the example that pops to my mind is Lost, where if you're a fan of Lost, you love Lost right up until about halfway through the last season, and then you think it's garbage and you hate it and you feel betrayed by the people who made it. And I think that there are some people who felt that way about Mass Effect 3. I, however, was not really one of them. I've played Mass Effect 3 before this show. And for those of you who aren't really in the loop of this, Mass Effect 3 came out. It got a really poor reception to the ending. Some people felt it was very rushed. Some people felt that it didn't live up to the legacy of the series, and it was a really sour note to end on.
Wasn't the ending so poorly received that they added a patch to fix it?
And yeah, that's where I was going with this, right? They added the extended cut was this free update they released a couple of weeks after the game came out. And honestly, if you following it at the time, it was a little bit sad. Like, you know, on the BioWare blog, they're all like, hey, look at us, we're working on it, we're working really hard for you, we love the fans and we want to listen to the fans. I had feelings about that at the time. One of them was, these people are entitled. Like, fuck me, these fans are entitled. Like, if you read some of the criticisms of it, it's like, Jesus Christ. Like, even it's okay if you don't like it, but demanding they fix it for you. Gamers are the worst at that. There's no other group of toxically entitled fans, I think, to the degree that we can be.
I don't know whether that's the language they've been taught to use.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't want to just be like, oh, they're entitled. I think that a lot of people are rather reasonable. The problem is they don't know how to communicate reasonable requests.
Yeah, but we're getting a little bit distracted here. I don't want to waste too much time on this.
Yeah.
But if you think about how some Star Wars fans reacted to The Last Jedi, how they've reacted to that, that's so uncool. Right? There's no shape of that, language that you can take where you can say, you've ruined this thing for me and you're evil for doing so. That kind of attitude is bad. And that was a very similar attitude to this Mass Effect 3 thing. Now, I bring all of this up because before this show, I only ever finished the original ending. And honestly, I didn't think it was that bad. I could see that, you know, it was the ending. Ending of games sometimes don't get as much attention because a lot of players don't get to them. They feel like that perhaps they ran out of time a little bit on it.
But endings are hard.
Endings are hard, basically. Yeah. So my problems with it were like, it's a little bit of a letdown. Endings are a little bit hard, I get it. But functionally, like the shape of it, I didn't have a problem with. And so when I was going back into this for this show, I was looking forward to seeing what changes they made. So that was a big thing I was expecting, this different kind of ending, whether whether or not it improved things or whether it might not made things worse.
Something they rushed out weeks after the game launched to alleviate fan fears.
Yeah, so there's that. But other than that, I was honestly expecting it to be a really, really tame retread of Mass Effect. I played a lot of Mass Effect before, replaying it for the show. You know, I've only played Mass Effect 3 once, so I probably should replay this one just so I have a bit of a more updated perspective, see that new ending. But what I thought was really interesting about my playthrough is that Mass Effect 1 and Mass Effect 2, we've talked about this before, one of my favorite series, right? I played both of those games at least 8, 10, 12 times.
As none of you have seen, David, he has Mass Effect, like the N7 logo tattooed on his forehead.
Not
right
just
now.
On my forehead, but every part of my body that could be visible under certain circumstances.
Yeah, it's quite
because
an effect.
I don't want it to be one of these things where, like, you know, maybe I'm wearing a hat that day.
Yeah,
people can't
exactly,
see.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, what if it's raining? I've got to wear a raincoat. Yeah. I've got to have it on, like, the backs of my hands and on the tip of my nose. Everyone's got to see this N7 tattoo.
Yeah, and those eyeball tattoos, that's real commitment, right?
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing. Even when someone's looking into my soul, they're looking into the soul of someone who loves Mass Effect.
Sorry, just the image of you covered in Mass Effect. Image? I mean the image before me.
And yeah, that lies before you right now. So I'm a huge fan of the series. I played 1 and 2 a lot.
A lot.
Mass Effect 3, I have only finished once before the show. So this is my second playthrough of that, and it's my first playthrough as a non-primary alignment. So my first playthrough was Paragon, this playthrough was Renegade. And what I was really struck by, like I was really surprised by replaying this, because I was doing something new in a Mass Effect game, something I haven't done in years and years and years, I was so struck at how affecting that was. And it was almost like, you know how in like a Red Dwarf, there's a character who erases his memories of all the Agatha Christie books so he can reread them and be surprised.
Yep.
It was almost a little bit like that. Like, I'm so, so familiar with Mass Effect 1 and so, so familiar with Mass Effect 2 that I played Mass Effect 3 and I was suddenly in unfamiliar territory. And it was, this is going to sound so bizarre, but in a good way, it was actually somewhat anxiety producing. Like,
really?
When I was, you know, being confronted with a lot of the big choices
the
that
stakes.
You make, the stakes, right? I felt a lot of conflict in myself as a player. And it's so interesting to go back to this because we kind of dismiss this era of moral choice as being ridiculously binary. And, you know, our nuance in like exploring themes now is so much better. And that's true. That is definitely true. Yeah. This is still very binary choices for the most part. But it still works. And I had this realization when I was playing Mass Effect 3 that, like, my God, I could play this series of games once every 2 or 3 years for the rest of my life and probably still enjoy it. Like, this is going to be my Harry Potter or my Lord of the Rings. That was so refreshing.
That's such a great point to bring. Because when I was playing this and finishing the trilogy and finishing the series, it really felt like this collection that works well together.
Yeah.
And that, depending on who you are, I feel like it hits wonderful, interesting beats the whole way through.
Mm.
And I was sort of struck by how much I was enjoying playing this one, specifically Mass Effect 3. I just found myself smiling as I was doing all the adventures, even if they were harrowing experiences, I couldn't help but enjoy them.
And like, part of me wonders if that is influenced by how much negative energy there is around this. I mean, recently you guested on Super Hype Train.
Yes.
And you mentioned that this is going to be an upcoming episode for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the reaction from the other hosts, like, you know, very legitimately, this is not coming from a point of judgment, was, oh, wow, I mean, I guess you get to see how that plane crashes, basically.
Yep.
Like, I think one of the comments was, oh, you got to see the rise, now you get to see the fall.
Yep.
Our memory, our cultural memory of what Mass Effect is so negative. And I think that Mass Effect 3 specifically is so negative. And I sometimes wonder if this surprise and joy that both of us felt going back to this game is influenced by how low the bar is set by the conversation.
Yeah, and I think that ending is going to be the most important thing to talk about.
Yeah, on that point, we are going to save that to the towards the end of the podcast.
To the actual end.
Yeah, because both because we want to keep you on the hook, but also, spoilers, right? We're going to try and do our general thing. Spoilers will drop some point in the episode. We'll warn you then. But we should actually probably get into the conversation about this game as it is.
So there was a lot of expectation around it, so it makes sense. Like, the idea of the ending and, like you said, the fall of it and that kind of stuff. But I think getting into the sort of meat of it and the experience of playing it is super important.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will start there, I think, with some good non-spoilery stuff. And we'll start with the conversation system. So, pillar of the series, right? You get to make these binary choices, that kind of thing. You have a morality.
Yeah.
At different points in conversations, you can use your strength of character to influence people. And if you've only been doing the paragon or good stuff up to this point,
yeah.
you've got a whole bunch of good points that allow you to improve the way you influence people in the good way.
Yeah, like handing out flowers or helping the ladies across the street, painting houses for
adopting
people.
Adopting puppies from puppy farms, that kind of thing.
So good.
So one of the big criticisms about the binary choice system in previous Mass Effect games is that you kind of had to commit to one alignment. Because if you want to get the most paragon points or good guy points or the most renegade points or bad guy points to use these best dialogue options, you had to grind those points up by only ever choosing that. One thing that I really liked about Mass Effect 3 is that your ability to use these best dialogue options that take, you know, this strength of character, this leadership quality that you build up through this mechanic, they're based on a system called reputation, which is the sum of your paragon points and your renegade points.
Yeah. I didn't notice that as I was playing, but it is there. You never feel like there's options unavailable to you.
Exactly. There was one point in the game where I noticed I could only do a renegade and couldn't do a paragon. For the rest of it, if you can do one, you can probably do the other because it's far more often based on your overall reputation score. So you feel much less penned in.
And that's my favorite way to drive the dialogues in these games. Because the idea of choosing what to say is very difficult. And like building these characters is hard. And I find that in the Mass Effect series, there's kind of a through line of who Commander Shepard is.
Yeah.
And you get to color how they behave. But really, Commander Shepard is a person. They're not a full blank slate.
And certainly when you compare it to something that's not restricted by the bounds of video games like Dungeons and Dragons, you have nowhere near that level of control over the character. But even compared to things like Dragon Age Origins or Skyrim, who your character is much more of the choices you make while you play them, because it's not really as narrative and plot focused. In this, you are right, there are parts of Shepard that you don't really control. And one of them is that Shepard cares about saving the galaxy. It's one of the things that you can't really change.
No matter how hard I try, I can't make Shepard give up and go to a bar and get drunk.
What I will say about the reputation and morality system that I think really works as well is that on that point of being able to choose how you play Shepard, more than any other game in the series, this one is make the smart choices. Like, you feel the consequences of your decisions so much more in terms of the fate of the galaxy than you did in Mass Effect 2 and Mass Effect 1, where it was more about, oh, I'm going for good guy points or bad guy points. Both from a narrative perspective and this mechanical perspective, they're really encouraging you to make decisions considering the consequences more so than what stats you'll get out of it.
Guess what, everyone? The Reapers are here. We've got to fight them, and we've got to win.
And if we don't,
we're all going to die. Yeah. And it's a perfect example of, as you say, the game is feeding into two strengths. It's using the narrative to drive home how important every decision is, and then it lets you build your reputation in a way that doesn't restrict you from doing things. And also, for me, it's fun because I love playing a good guy Shepard who's the nice boy who helps all the orphans and lets old lady cross the street, but then also will just shout and punch and shoot people occasionally, or, as I did in Mass Effect 2, just straight up headbutt a Krogan.
Yeah, so the interrupts do come back, which is what John's referring to there. And once again, they're not restricted by your points either. At any point, if there's an interrupt available, you can use it.
The only tiny little niggle that I find for these interrupts is it would be great because a lot of the classes have biotic powers. It'd be great to see it, maybe a biotic variant or two here, but it's like they do all the cutscenes as if Commander Shepard is a soldier.
Yeah, right? they really do.
Which is fine, right? But I would just like to see Commander Shepard, like, put up a shield or something, or throw a man across a room.
Especially since there are points in, this happens more so in Mass Effect 2, but if there's a point where you got a Mexican standoff, is that offensive?
I don't know. We should do some research and come back.
Right. There's a point where you've got an armed standoff,
there you
right?
go. Save
and it. If you've got characters with you and they have biotics, they light up their biotics as part of that standoff, and you really notice if you're a biotic and you just pull out a gun.
Yeah, especially if you rarely use them. You're just
I see. I played a Vanguard in this, which is the violent biotic class, and so anytime there's a scene where they're like, oh no, Shepard doesn't have her gun, I'm just like, that's not a problem at all. Yeah. I barely use the thing.
Yeah, and like, I played the Engineer, and I just shoot explosive balls of fire and ice from my hands.
Like, you just shooting off like Jim Dark magic.
Just, yeah, I feel like I'm a combat wizard. Like, they could just be packing some biotic heat.
I do get what you mean there, and obviously you've made that point that like when they're designing these cutscenes, they need to design them universally from a resource perspective, I guess. But there are definitely some really standout ones.
And I noticed a lot of my complaints with the game, I feel like, are probably budgetary concerns.
Yeah.
They made choices to make the game easier to make, and I get it. But also, I think the other thing I noticed too was what we've kindly referred to as eavesdropping Shepard.
Yeah, so I actually really like this. I don't know how you feel about it.
I like it. Like, it's fine because it's like a thing happens in the world, but there's a comic, I can't remember what it is. It's just the idea of Shepard approaching strangers, saying nothing, giving them a wink, and then coming back later with the thing they want.
Yeah, so there's a lot of points in the game where you're walking past someone, like, on the phone or in a chat with someone else being all like, oh, damn, we need these power converters to help our ships, but how are we going to get these power converters?
Oh, I was totally going to help the war effort, but we lost the MacGuffin.
Yeah, and so then while you're scanning around the galaxy, you might stumble across these power converters that they need and you show back up. So there's a couple of reasons why I like this, and the main reason is it's just faster. So in previous Mass Effects, you actually had to go up and hit A on the person or hit enter or whatever and enter a dialogue sequence, and you had to ask the questions and get the information and then leave.
So, and that is such a noticeable thing that in this Mass Effect, they've streamlined a lot of
A lot of the incidental tier 3 side quests, like the side quests that are not really plot relevant at all, are pretty much all these. So you acquire them just by walking around. You don't even have to stop and talk to anyone. The other thing, too, is that this kind of comes up in conversations with your crewmates as well. So you've got the classic memes, right, of Shepard going up to Rex, and you have the whole, Shepard, Rex, Shepard, Rex, Shepard, Rex. Or in Mass Effect 2, Garrus needing to do his calibrations. Because if you go up to Garrus, and he's got nothing to say, he says he's in the middle of calibrations, and then the conversation ends. In this, they save it by not having you enter a dialogue sequence unless the character has something to say. Mm-hmm. So it's much faster when you're walking around the ship just to check if anybody's got some new stuff to talk about, to just get through it. And if there's no like strong interactions from Shepard or from the other character, it just plays out very quickly and very easily, and it doesn't interrupt the flow as much. I'm actually a huge fan of this.
Yeah, when you talk about it from that perspective, I'm totally on board, because those very frustrating menu systems, especially when you'd go into a menu and you'd be like, do you have anything important to say? And then Garrus would tell you about calibrations again, and you'd be like, oh! And even with your personal assistant, who is basically there to flag people who have interesting things to say to you, which is still in this game, it didn't flow super well. And so moving to this kind of intuitive, just automatic system, totally respect it.
Yeah, I think that it works better. And the truth is, it is a little bit funny when you think about it consciously, of like this guy just floating up to people with the exact MacGuffin they need to cure this toxin or whatever, and then disappearing into the night.
And also,
it's very dumb, but it's also, it just works.
And also, if you find the magical MacGuffin beforehand, you just turn up to them and be like, oh, it's here. Like, I got it.
Yeah, I already got it. Yeah. Go to my ship. Give them my name. They'll give it to you.
Yes. The new meme is, go to docking bay, blah, blah, blah. It's there. My favorite thing, though, was some of the background conversations, too, which really stepped up from the second Mass Effect.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as, like, building atmosphere, it's so much better than previous ones, because, you don't have to stop and talk to someone to hear about what's happening in the world. Yeah.
And again, I think they still did this really impressive thing for me, where even though Mass Effect 1 had large, expansive environments, and 2 and 3, the sort of hubs are kind of are way smaller, they still feel just as dense.
Yeah, and one of the things that really works about that ties into this automatic conversation thing we're talking about, because in Mass Effect 1 and 2, the whole premise of them is that you're almost fighting this secret war that nobody knows about. In Mass Effect 3, it's a conventional war. The galaxy is in a state of war with an enemy that is defeating them. And you see the effects of that in the world around you. And I think that that's really, really impressive, because there are many games that don't want to get that gritty about it. They want you to be the hero and you're just flying around doing cool stuff. But they actually talk a lot about refugees and like the logistics of that. And
that felt really weird to see in a game.
Yeah, I know, right?
Especially a game that came out like what feels like ages ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, five or six years ago at this point.
Again, shouldn't excuse the fact that there's refugees in the game.
Like, yeah.
It blows my mind that people don't talk about that in other games.
And it's a very respectful kind of approach to that topic. Like, they don't go too hardcore into it from Shepard's. Like, Shepard doesn't manage that problem, but it's presented as a problem that, you know, people are displaced by war, and we're walking through the docking bay where the refugees are getting processed, and you have, you know, a 15 or 16-year-old girl waiting for her parents to show up and not knowing if they will. You know, and so you overhear a lot of these conversations that just show the state of the galaxy. And one of the things I find really pleasant about that as well is that it not only does it give you room to see the consequences of what's happening and appreciate the gravity of what's happening and not overly romanticize war. I mean, it is still an action game, right? Mm. But not over.
A lot of talk about dying with honor and
all that kind of thing. Yeah. So it still definitely romanticizes that kind of soldier hero worship thing, but it also does still present at least more of it than most games do. One of the other things I really appreciated about it is it still allows room for hope and positivity and faith in people, because, you know, a lot of this varies in popularity, but if you think about something like Game of Thrones and the way it approaches war, everyone in that world is dark. Pretty much everyone in that world is out for themselves. It's like the world's a horrible, cold place and you only survive it by being terrible and exploiting people. Everyone's basically in zombie survival mode 100% of the time.
Yes.
Whereas in this, you see people going out of their way to help other people. Like, there's one conversation I remember in the embassy where you have a woman, she and her partner have to ship out because they're both soldiers and they're trying to get their daughter to their family to take care of her while they're fighting. And, you know, they're having this back and forth with this clerk about the difficulty of getting her, finding her a ship, and, you know, the difficulty of getting the paperwork through and contacting people who can take custody of her. And as you go past this conversation a couple of times, you get it in little snippets, but eventually you find that this clerk has called in a couple of favors and stayed up a couple of nights just to help this person.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of little things like that. And it sounds maybe small and maybe even unrealistic, but I really appreciate how much hope there is and how they work to instill your faith in other people.
And I think a lot of those conversations that you overhear, especially when you go back to a place. So when you come back to the Citadel again and again, the one that comes to mind for me is in the embassies, where there's an older woman who is going up to the clerk and asking about her son. But the clerk is her son's fiance.
I don't think that it actually is her fiance.
Oh, well, that's like the implication is that her son was involved romantically with the clerk and is probably dead. And that's why there'll never be a response.
I read that differently. The son is engaged to an Asari. And so this older woman, in a kind of a little bit of a racist way, says, oh, you remind me so much of my son's fiance. But this older woman has dementia.
So when you listen to a lot of the dialogue options, the Asari knows this woman and actually calls her like by name and talks about it.
Because she's come back every day asking the same questions about where her son is, and her son is probably dead.
Yeah, and when I read that, I read it as extra sad, because it's the idea of someone who should know you doesn't recognize you anymore, because eventually the older woman flits in and out of not recognizing the Asari and then not knowing why they're there, and the Asari clerk will be like, oh, I've got the, you know, the paperwork here for you, I'll handle that. And it's just this weird kind of sadness. But there's a lot of vignettes like that that are just wonderful background stories that you just witness or take part in too.
Yeah, there's another one that sticks in my mind, of this couple who one of their partners is on the front lines and they've been deployed for a while, and, you know, they were having romantic problems and they're talking about the difficulty of ending that relationship now that the person, you know, they're out there risking their lives and they feel guilty about trying to end the relationship now. It's just a lot of difficult emotional effects of a state of war on people. And it's just a really good atmosphere building. And
this is getting in the game where most of the time you run around shooting people with laser rifles.
Yeah, exactly. It's just to polish that topic off, doing that work makes the narrative stronger. Yeah. And there are a number of points where it's easy to forget the stakes, and they work well to continue to remind you of them.
I feel like it's very rare that you forget the fate of the galaxy hangs in the balance. And like, I joke, but like in other games, decisions might be left on their own. But in this, not only are there moral decisions to make, but they also affect your troop numbers as well.
Yeah, and so that's the sort of the core mechanic of the game, is that the basic premise is that Commander Shepard is trying to assemble, you know, an alliance of different
races, a massive space army.
Massive space army to fight the Reapers.
Yeah.
So your main through line is the big main quests are about securing massive support, but all of your side quests are about smaller ways that you can help the fighting forces of your side. So, like, you know, we were talking before about this particular group of people need some power converters. If you give them the power converters, then the ships are able to get repaired slightly faster, and that improves your military effectiveness.
And in previous Mass Effect games, you sort of gathered resources in different ways. In the first one, you would drive around on the ground in a buggy and you'd sort of scan objects and get out and collect minerals that way. In the second game, there was the ever famous and popular drone mineral harvesting game.
Yeah, where you sort of scan the planet from space, but it's very slow and grindy and it's not super engaging.
Yeah, yeah. And in this one, they've just opted that your ship has a scan button and you just scan.
So the Reapers have occupied a whole bunch of different star systems, and the Normandy has stealth, so it keeps you hidden. But as you actively scan for stuff on planets that can reveal your location, if you do it too many times, the Reapers find you and they chase you out of the star system. If they capture you, game over. I actually quite like this system because it's better than the ones that have come before it by a long way. And it also means that you can't just fly around and get everything you want. I like it because it reminds you of the threat of the Reapers. And if one of them catches you, you're done. You can't fight them.
It just goes straight game over.
Yeah. The advantage that you have over them is secrecy. That's what your advantage is. It is surprise and it is subterfuge. You cannot defeat them conventionally. And I think that this mechanic reflects that. It also lets you do something I like, which is go to different star systems, explore around a little bit, and it does make the galaxy feel a little bit bigger.
Without having you go to every planet and look everywhere and search under every rock.
Exactly.
It balances the two. So it lets you explore the galaxy, and you can look at every planet and read the bio if you really want to, but you can also just hit that scan button a few times and it will tell you where to go.
Yeah, and I just think overall it works the best, and you still manage your fuel as you're flying around and that kind of thing, so it's enough.
I think it's time to talk about space violence now.
Yeah, so one of the big things that I think you appreciated, John, is that now any class can use any gun.
Right? Oh, that was so... It sounds silly, but it was nice. And the reason why...
Yeah, it is a massive improvement.
The reason why I was so glad was because they've done a lot of work in Mass Effect 3 to make all of the weapons different and interesting to use.
Yes, that's a huge thing that I forget about it until I go back to playing the game.
Not only do all the guns feel different, but each race's sort of weapons feel different as well.
Yeah, so in Mass Effect 2, you had different loadouts you could pick, but it was pretty much just rate of fire differences, you know? So you'd have like the slow shooting heavy pistol or the fast shooting light pistol.
And in the second one, only the heavy weapons had such a distinct variation to
them. Absolutely. Whereas in this, you've got different cultures produce different kinds of weapons. So the Geth, for example, are all about fast-firing weapons that have low recoil and shred shields very quickly because their primary fight is with Quarians, who are all about shield technology.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Krogan that have these huge, heavy weapons that fire slow and hard and just shred anything they touch.
I think one of them's like a harpoon gun or something.
Yeah, I think the Batarians have a lot of like harpoon weapons.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And the Asari have a lot of weapons that are about control, so they'll cause knockback or stuns and that kind of thing. And so not only are there different play styles, but completely different feel and aesthetic designs to the weapons as well.
Just absolutely stellar. I'm so impressed.
It feels a little bit weird to be all like, oh, and the guns just look so good. Yeah. But the visual design of the weapons in this is so much better than anything that came before it.
Yeah, and seeing as it is the primary way you engage with the game, unless you turn on, we haven't actually played it. There's a version that sort of removes... There's a story.
Yeah, there's like adjust the story mode. I don't know if it eliminates combat entirely, but it does specify that combat takes a huge backseat. And I think it even goes so far as to say that this is not the full Mass Effect experience.
Yeah. But in this one, I was struck by how interesting it was to play the combat sections. I felt like one was a real slog. Two, sort of started to figure some things out with the arena placement and some of the weapon types, the different enemy types.
And the way powers and stuff work was completely revamped in 2.
Yeah, and just going to 3, it really feels like they mastered that design philosophy.
Yeah.
The balance between your powers and how you could carry every weapon you wanted. You have all different types of weapons. It would just reduce your cooldowns on your powers.
Yeah, so every weapon has a weight, and the more weight you're carrying, the longer it takes for your powers to recharge. So if you play a Vanguard like me, who has a power focus, you want light weapons so that you can zip around all over the place. But if you play like a soldier that has very few powers that are generally a lot more passive, then you want to carry as many guns as you want into battle because that's your way of fighting.
And then that's just a fun... Let's just give you decisions to make about what weapons you're using.
Yeah, I think that you made this comment about Horizon Zero Dawn. Decisions in combat are only fun if they're meaningful. If you're just deciding, oh, I will use this gun that does more damage per second, that's not a decision. That's a calculation.
If you give me an option that is just better, you should apply it automatically. If your character finds a better gun that is just better but feels exactly the same, it should just come. Or it should have already been there and you're... The game should be designed differently.
Yeah, the feel of combat is tighter as well. Like, the difference between Mass Effect 1 and 2 is a huge leap, and this is closer to 2 than 2 was to 1, but they just have polished everything. And so, like, as a Vanguard, you have this biotic charge that basically teleports you to an enemy and causes a little explosion when you land. And my God, does that feel good. Like, the timing and the audio design on the guns that you use, they all feel like they have a bit more punch behind them now.
And it's still always as fun as ever to curve some of your special powers, because you can lock onto someone but then look away and it will, the shot will, like, curve around walls.
Yeah,
and stuff
so you
like
can
that.
Hit them behind cover, just like bullet curving out of Wanted. It's, yeah. Just, it's a really good system, and I'm surprised that for a game that isn't really lauded for its combat, I've not played another game where you can curve bullets or powers like this. And it's very fun and sort of, from a gameplay perspective, very intuitive to do.
That's a great point. From what I would call a very conventional cover-based shooter, which is kind of what Mass Effect does, and they've also opened up the movement system. So in previous Mass Effects, you stormed, I think is what they called it, where you would charge in a straight line, essentially, with a little bit of flex.
Yeah, this is kind of where you quote-unquote sprint.
Yeah, and it was always like, I want to run straight at that thing, or straight to there, or what have you. But in this one... you hit that storm button and you can turn, David. David, you can turn 90 degrees, David.
We should talk about the melee as well, actually, because they've added, in the previous ones, it was a very lame kind of... You just kind of bop them with your gun.
Yeah.
In this one, they added a heavy melee where if you're a soldier or a non-biotic class, your Omnitool generates this basically hollow blade and you do a huge stab with it. If you're a biotic, you do a psychic punch.
Yeah.
And all of these are so much fun, and they make this kind of movement system and a lot of the close combat options much more varied, where before it was just, I have a shotgun, bang, bang, bang.
And they balance it so well, because you can do this charge, but you have to wait for it to load and you have to stand in the open. So choosing when to do the heavy attack and when to just hit someone and when to hide and cover all opens up. And then on top of that, there's three different styles of enemy you fight.
Yeah, so this has the most enemy variety of any Mass Effect game as well. In Mass Effect 1, you were pretty much always fighting the Geth and occasionally some humans.
Yeah, or some
Krogan.
It'll be the mercenary packs were in all the games, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but in Mass Effect 1, it was basically just about how much health this character has. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think you talked about it. There's no combat puzzles. They all just walk straight at you.
Yep.
In Mass Effect 2, the AI was much better, and you had two or three main sort of classes of enemies. You know, you had humanoid-style enemies, mechs, and sort of Krogan-tier enemies. In this, you have three entirely different main factions.
Yeah.
So you've got the Reapers, which now have a whole range of different ground forces.
All of which are taken from the races they're fighting.
Yeah, you basically have zombie versions of all of the different races.
Yeah, not only just the human husks, you have Turian mechanics who boost other Reaper forces. And I was just super impressed by the variety within that single type of enemy.
Yeah, after that, you've got Cerberus, which is like this...
it's a pro-human group.
Yeah, they're the space KKK.
Yeah,
and they're super, super well equipped because they're like a black ops splinter cell sort
owned
of thing.
By an eccentric billionaire.
Yeah,
stuff like
and
that.
So their whole playstyle is totally different because they're a lot more about tech, and the way they move is much more tactical.
And
like
cover focus. Yeah,
so you have guys that have riot shields, basically engineers that deploy shields and turrets. Like, it's a lot more phalanxy, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
It's more about formations and that kind of thing. And then you've got the Geth, which are not a huge part of the game, but you do fight the Geth again, like you did in Mass Effect 1. And they're almost focused on strong central
units
that enhance the units around them. So they have juggernauts and flamers and stealth. And so they're a lot more about centralizing their strength. And so from the broad enemy type perspective, it's a lot more engaging. And then you also have the variety within each of those types as well.
And then you couple that with all the tools you have at your disposal and all the weapons and everything like that. I feel like this game is a clear trajectory upwards in terms of gameplay.
And I think that we need to pay our respects to the multiplayer focus of the game for some of the improvements in the combat system.
Yeah, surprise, Mass Effect has a multiplayer.
So this came out in 2012 where Gears of War was the shit still, and you've basically got the Horde mode that every single game was trying to put out. But it's pretty solid here. Yeah. And
I mean, admittedly, it's pretty hard to go wrong with Horde modes.
Yeah.
But they have put in a genuine effort. In fact, me and David played some of it as well, and I had a great time with it.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that, I think we'll probably chuck that up on YouTube, right?
Yep, that means we actually have to put it up. So yes, there will be a video. Maybe it's broken into two, we're not sure yet, but there'll be at least footage of us playing the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just having a blast?
Yeah, like it was genuinely quite fun, especially since there were only two of us, and I think the max team size is 4 or 5. Yeah.
Oh, and we were playing on the lowest difficulty as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's part of the reason why I think we were able to still have fun with two people. But again, what I really like about this as well is it lets you play different classes, because a big problem with this style of RPG is you pick your class right at the start. You might not even really know what the playstyle that's going to be.
Yeah, I remember still that going to Mass Effect 1 and being like, I have no idea what any of this means.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And I have to choose permanently for the whole game.
The multiplayer in this gives you an arena to test out different classes. So, I mean, none of the classes are boring, I don't think, from my perspective. I have fun with all of them.
I might have been a bit negative while we were playing because it was very hot while I was recording. But after you play a little bit and get some variety in the guns and stuff you have, and that part opens up, having the powers from the game and having that variety just adds to the fun.
Yeah, so I'm more getting to the point that, like, let's say I choose a soldier for the single player campaign.
Yes.
In Mass Effect 1 or Mass Effect 2, I am pretty much stuck with that choice the whole way through.
Oh,
I can replay the single player if I want to. And so when you get to like 30% of the way through and you're playing the soldier, for example, I might be all like, damn, am I missing out because I picked the wrong class? You know, I don't actually know. Whereas if you've got the multiplayer in this, I still get the satisfaction of knowing how an engineer plays and knowing how a biotic plays.
And how their powers are used.
Yeah.
And I think the whole multiplayer has this cute gimmick where it ties into your war readiness rating.
Mm.
So not only are you building war assets, but there's a percentage. At the start of the game, I think it halves it at 50%, right?
Yeah.
And the more of the multiplayer you play, it goes up.
Yeah, so if you succeed in a Horde mode run, you get like plus 10 or 12% to your readiness rating. If you fail, you'll get somewhere between like 2 and 6% to your readiness rating.
We don't know how much you get when you win, because we didn't win.
Oh, I've won them in the past. I just didn't win any with you.
Oh, okay. I don't know why that would be.
So one of the things I think is interesting as well, don't hold me to this. To get a maximum readiness bar full and get all of the options that come along with that, I think that caps at 2,800 is the score you need. By about 2/3 of the way through the game, I had met that, even though my multiplayer readiness rating was at 0. So my power was halved, but I still met that about 2/3 of the way through the game.
Yeah,
I think they've changed that. I think that when the game came out, you needed to play a little bit of multiplayer if you wanted to max that thing out.
But now they've just
Now I got there without even trying.
Yeah, no,
like, so I wasn't even thinking about it and I maxed that out.
So did I, yeah.
Then again, I will say when I played Paragon, my first playthrough, I made decisions that weren't as good for the readiness rating as they could have been because I was trying to do the good person thing.
Just being too nice, David.
You're just being too nice.
Save the
this
universe.
Character that I played here, I played him Renegade. I made some cold motherfucking decisions, and maybe that's why I filled that out much faster.
Okay, yeah. I was playing a nice character, and I found it rather easy, even to get the minimum that the game literally tells you you need.
Yeah, so the minimum is the minimum you need to get to the ending.
Yeah.
But this is not a massive spoiler, but the basic way the end of the game works is there are multiple endings that you can get for the game. For you to have the ability to choose certain endings, you need to have a certain readiness rating. So the fuller your bar is, the more options you have at the end of the game, but it doesn't necessarily preclude you from the ending that you want if that's the easiest one to get to, you know?
Yeah,
so you still choose, but you have more options the fuller that bar is.
Yeah, and basically it just means more prepared the galaxy is. So
yeah.
Different characters may or may not die, depending and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a very nice feature. I genuinely was so impressed by how much fun I had actually playing Mass Effect when things just weren't going on. So, I don't know why I was so surprised. I know people told me. People said that the gameplay in Mass Effect 3 was genuinely fun.
Okay.
And I had a great time.
Yeah, I'm surprised that anybody had... Like, this is perhaps the cynic in me, but from the way you hear people talk about Mass Effect 3 now, they don't tend to talk about it very in-depth, but it's almost the way people talk about Arkham Knight. It's this black stain, and it's an easy punching bag. So I'm surprised you heard anything positive about it at all.
I listened to some very unloved critics, so they have quite unpopular opinions.
Yeah. Now, I think that we're at the point now where we should start talking about the story proper. A lot of this probably still would be spoiler-free, but we may as well put the spoiler warning in here now. If you want to play Mass Effect 3 without spoilers 6 years after its release, I guess.
David! I just did that. You make a joke, I did that.
For most games, because they're not part of a series, I don't feel quite as ridiculous suggesting it. Obviously, you know, if you're that person, awesome. You know, it's never too late to enjoy a good game.
I did it, so can you.
Yeah, but it does feel a little bit weird. Like, I feel like Mass Effect, more than a lot of games, is if you were going to play it, you probably would have by now.
And if you weren't going to play it but wanted to know what happened, you read the wiki.
All right, so let's talk about the story structure. So one of the big ones is we talked about the whole idea that you're building up this force to try and prepare yourself against the Reapers. So previous games in this series were not so much nonlinear, but very branching. In Mass Effect 1, you had the start section, but then you had 3 or 4 main missions you could choose from and do them in any order, and then you did the end of the game. In Mass Effect 2, it kind of came in chunks, but you still could choose which characters you wanted to recruit first. And so there's a lot of decision about what order things happen in. Mm-hmm. This game is much more linear, much, much more linear. You have these tier 3 side quests, which are like, I need some rocks. You got the rocks. Here are your rocks.
Yeah.
You can kind of do them whenever you want. But tier 2 side quests and tier 1 main quests are given to you at specific times. And so your tier 2 side quests are often things like, this particular Turian general needs you to do this mission now. It's not obligatory for the plot, but it is fully scripted. It has a story, and it comes at a relevant point in the game that makes sense for it.
Yeah.
Hey, you're on T'Chanka to recruit the Krogans. While you're here, there's this huge important thing we need to do while we're on T'Chanka.
Yeah, that thing was really important.
Yeah, it was super important.
So I'm not that bothered when a game chooses to do a more linear story.
Oh, absolutely not.
Because I feel like playing Mass Effect 3, it tells a really engaging story about a galaxy at war and the fight that everybody, because you go to everybody, basically, right? You see what's happening, how they're all having to deal with this war against the Reapers.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, I've already talked about, like, the effects of the war, but it's so compelling to... Okay, this is very early on in the game, but it is kind of a big spoiler. One of my expectations for Mass Effect 3 was that the Reapers were going to show up, shit was going to get bad, we were going to have to prepare for them, and it would probably end with a huge big fight. Probably at Earth, but maybe at the Citadel.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a big fight, and Earth is going to be in the balance, and it's going to be really bad. So I thought that's going to be the end of the game. Turns out that's the start of the game. The first thing that happens is that the Reapers show up and take Earth. And you're like, what the fuck? Oh, I am out. Oh, no.
Hello. It's us, the Reapers. We just jump past all your defenses.
Yeah.
Because we don't care, because we're a machine race of things that resurrect your dead to fight for us.
Yeah, they don't have supply lines and all this kind of stuff that makes them very difficult to fight.
But it's something that you talk about a lot in the game as well.
Yeah, one of the things that's really compelling about this is that they hit so hard and so fast. Like, that initial strike, that Blitzkrieg, hit everyone and took everyone off guard. The Batarians are gone. That section of space is gone. Most of the Human Systems Alliance is in disarray. Thessia, the Asari homeworld, Palavin, the Turian homeworld, all of them are under attack.
Yeah.
And you're going to people saying, my homeworld needs your soldiers. And they're like, motherfucker, my homeworld needs my fucking soldiers.
We all got stuff going on. The galaxy is at war.
Yeah. And what's so compelling about that is that you have a plan and you have to try and get people to believe in it and follow you. This is where a lot of these incredibly difficult decisions come in. Like I was saying earlier that playing as this renegade character was harder for me than playing as the Paragon, because whenever I was conflicted about something, I could step back and go, you know what the right thing to do here is. Do that.
Yeah.
You know, that's an easy decision to make. You can always take it back to which of these hurts fewer people, which is the kinder thing to do. As this renegade character, all of my motivation as the way I built this character was, the galaxy will end unless I do things perfectly.
Yep.
And every decision I make has to prioritize the safety of the civilizations that live in this galaxy. And there are times where the decisions were so, so hard for me to make because they were cold, callous decisions. Mm. And I was actively choosing not to do that thing where it's like, oh, yeah, but it's a game, so everything will turn out fine. I'm the hero. I'm going to get it done one way or the other, right? You know, I deliberately...
Which
walked away from that style of thinking.
Which is kind of it's like a little gentle niggle in the back of your mind. Mm. If you play through the game as a nicey nice person being nice, you kind of do know that it will be nice. The ending will work out. You can make some more kinder decisions than you probably think should pay off.
Yeah.
And still survive thy entire galaxy being invaded by massive machines.
Yeah, by Cthulhu space robots. Yeah.
Thinking of the enemies in Mass Effect, you think about Mass Effect 1 where you had Saren and Sovereign and that was the kind of secret war you were waging. And then in Mass Effect 2, you're fighting the Collectors and that stuff. There's something about the Reapers being an unstoppable force that has existed many cycles previously.
Yeah, like millions upon millions of years.
Right. Oh, this cycle? Oh, it's happening. It happens every cycle. It happened in our cycle. Happened in your cycle. Right? This is not going to be the last one. What do you mean? They always do this. Always happens. Oh, it builds so well. And I think the story, like the way it's focused, just lends itself to this.
They do work on that, on what the Reapers are and what it feels like to fight something that is so unknown. And they have, I wouldn't say it's quite cosmic horror, but they do lean into the monstrous unknown, this thing that's so much larger than us. I do want to take a quick moment here and mention that on top of all of this really big plot stuff, end of the galaxy, Reapers are coming.
Gotta save the world.
Gotta save the world. One of the things that I often forget when I think back on this is that every game in the Mass Effect series does examine very interesting themes at different levels of intensity. So the big choices you have in this one are about whether or not you'll finally cure the genophage or whether or not you decide to leave it as it is. Another big question is how the whole thing between the Geth and the Quarians are going to go. And so all of these things are talking about synthetic intelligence, AI and organic life. They're talking about politics and colonialism and gender and proxy wars and all of this kind of thing. A really big one is that the Krogan, you get a lot more insight into their culture in this game.
Yep.
So you see the role that women have in their society and how before the genophage was enacted and made whatever percentage of Krogan births fail.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. Like what that did to women's position in Krogan society. So prior to the genophage, women had leadership roles in Krogan society. And a big part of that was because of their responsibility as matriarchs and as mothers, right? And so there are issues about how the race examines gender that I don't think are, ignored, but aren't necessarily the core focus of it. But when the genophage comes in and affects Krogan society and its view of what motherhood is and its view of what women's role in society is, that's part of why their culture has collapsed. And you know, you see a lot more through mainly this one Krogan character who's called Eve, which is a shit name. They should have tried harder than that.
But it did feel a bit
being the first Krogan to be cured of the genophage and be capable of being a mother and what her leadership role would be in their hopes for the new Krogan society after the genophage, you see so much more about that. And it asks a lot of questions about gender relations and whether or not this culture is healthier by segmenting is so strictly along gender lines or whether it's worse, you know?
Yeah.
And there's essentialist arguments in that as well. Like I said, it's not perfect, but it's very interesting to see this culture that you have only seen men in before this game and is so built around toxically masculine traits like violence and dominance and that kind of thing. And seeing that maybe this culture is like this, not because all Krogans are violent and evil, but because they have lost touch with the feminine elements of their culture and what that means for the cultural trauma of this society that has had a genocidal weapon applied to them, you know?
It's so interesting because this happens while all the galaxy ending stuff happens, right? You're still worrying about the Reapers and then the game goes and asks you questions like, should we try and heal this civilization? Should we put faith here? What should we do? Like, what do you think?
Yeah.
And I don't know too many games that balance these kinds of themes and even like micro themes and packing them in. It's like every story that happens
is
full of them.
And once again, like when we think back on Mass Effect 3 5 years later, we think about the lackluster ending and that we're just so concerned with the plot that we're just rushing through and tying up all the loose ends.
Genuinely, we just think about the ending.
Yeah, and we forget all of these moment-to-moment thematic points and these character moments that is... I won't say it's the best in the series, but there are some moments that are the best in the series.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's really important to point at stuff like that. Now, another controversy around Mass Effect 3 was that one of the characters, Javik, was paid DLC, day one launch DLC.
Mm.
But he explores a whole bunch of stuff because he's the last Prothean, right?
Oh, and yes!
This is so good. Like, he is a character in and of himself I don't find too interesting. He's all about revenge and getting the Reapers because he was in a cryopod. He's the only surviving Prothean from that cycle.
The most interesting thing, though, is the concept of who the Protheans actually are.
Yeah.
And how Galactic Society viewed them, whereas how they're seen through the lens of Javik.
So... one of the points that you made, which I think was really insightful before the show, is that the Protheans are sort of the way we think about ancient Rome.
I think ancient Rome's a perfect example
because
you think of them as these builders of wondrous technologies, of bringing so much to the galaxy, and they're kind of revered by galactic culture. Oh, they must have been these peaceful, wonderful
scientists. They were so enlightened. Yeah. And,
they provided us so much knowledge that we've learned from them about how to manipulate Mass Effect fields and stuff like that. And then you meet Javik, who is the personification of vengeance, and the whole mannerism and style is that of imperialistic Rome.
Yeah, he is a soldier, and he talks about how their empire spanned the galaxy and they subjugated other races to serve them and their glorious vision. We brought unity to the and it's so imperialistic and so colonial.
And they use Liara, because she's a longtime archaeologist of Prothean artifacts, and then she writes notes on dealing with and interacting with Javik that sort of illustrate how wrong everyone's perspective was.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because, you know, in our real world, when we talk about ancient Rome, there's a lot of people in the West, and for a very long time, we celebrated ancient Rome as this model that we should base our society on. I mean, the Renaissance did it, and we do it to the Renaissance and also to classicalism. It's like they're so philosophical and so enlightened, but super violent, and they had slaves and shit. Like
everyone had slaves. Like there were slaves everywhere.
It's
in ancient Rome.
It's a dark imperial colonial society from many ways to examine it.
It turns out when you don't have basic public healthcare and scientific knowledge, you just have to enslave everybody to create a system.
Yeah, and I think that it's one of these things. I missed that message the first time. I got the whole thing. It's like, oh, we thought the Protheans were great, but they weren't. But I didn't realize how perfectly that parallel to how we romanticize the classical era.
It's a little disappointing that was day one DLC that you had to pay for, because I feel like that story is so vital to the narrative of Mass Effect.
Yeah, and I mean, not just the narrative, but on the character level as well. One of the big things that you have in this one is the legend of Shepard, because by this point, people know that you've done shit.
That you probably died and came back to life and saved the galaxy from the collectors.
So people know who you are, and there's this mystique around you, and it turns out that all of the crazy rantings that you had for the past years turned out to be totally true. The Reapers did show up, and we're all in deep shit. I guess we'll talk to the person who's been saying this is going to be happening for the past 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But one of the things I really like on a character perspective in this is they take a lot of other characters and contrast them with Shepard in some ways. One of the main ones is Garrus. And Garrus, of course, Garrus comes back. Fan favorite Garrus.
Garrus!
Space bros.
Yeah, there's a lot of character interactions. It always surprises me that there never feels like there's enough. Like, you'd have to take a squad mate with you on every mission to get the kind of dialogue and connection that I feel like people had. Because I tend to mix up my roster, so I feel like that, in a way, helps not build a connection in the same way.
And I think that how you think of your own character also colors those relationships. So, like, when I play my Paragon character, I feel like the strongest relationships I have on the ship are with Tali, because Tali is very, very capable and, depending on how you play, potentially in a leadership position like you are to some extent. But she's also a highly compassionate person. She's also super cute. That's sort of to the side, not really as relevant.
David, are you blushing right now, David?
A little bit.
Okay.
You can't see it through my opaque Quarian visor. But like
I can't see the tattoos, though.
Yeah. My Paragon character relates very well to her. My Renegade character, I feel, relates very well to Garrus. And Garrus is, to the Turians, kind of what you are to the humans and the rest of the galaxy. He is the one that they're all like, motherfucker, we have no idea how to deal with the Reapers. Tell us what to do.
Yeah.
And so he's making a lot of these hard decisions that you have to make. And you and he talk about the burden of that a lot. And what you say to him influences the advice he gives to the generals and stuff that are asking him for help. And so there's this incredible empathy of pressure between the two of you. And I think that this game, more than any other, talks a lot about the emotional effect of being in this position on not just Shepard, but on all of the characters in the crew. They all have moments of despair and stuff at what they're facing and what's happening to their people.
I was just so impressed by every interaction you have with the main roster.
Yeah.
Even if it's just for brief moments, because not all the characters from previous games come back, but even the short missions you might get with someone, like you're with Rex and you're going through Kieran the Genophage and stuff like that. Or for me, when I went to the Grissom Academy, I think it was.
Yeah.
Because I romanced Jack in Mass Effect 2. And so when Jack turns up, it's all like steamy romance all of a sudden. And you're like, oh, awesome. This is what I want from the game.
Yeah, she punched me.
she punched me as well. But then we made out.
Yeah.
It's so everyone feels full of life.
Yeah, and I think that for the most part, they do a really good job of knowing who they need to focus on and who they don't. Like, Grunt shows up, but he just gets a little side mission that isn't super important, whereas Rex is much bigger. Morden is very big. Tally and Garrus, obviously, we've already mentioned. Yeah. One of the other things I really like is how they put a little bit more focus on non-combat members of the Normandy crew. So you've got Cortez, who's the shuttle pilot, and you've got Trainer, who's the signal analyst, and sort of also your personal assistant, because she's bored, I guess. But not only are they both romance options, but they also are very full characters throughout the game. And it's nice to see that they put a little bit more focus on characters like Joker and Trainer and Cortez, who aren't valuable because of how good they are with a gun.
Yeah. And speaking of romance options, I think they kind of just, in Mass Effect 3, they're kind of just like, just let people choose. Just choose.
Yeah, the romance options felt a little bit less heavy in this one.
Because I romanced Liara in the first game. She just shows up and she's like, look, are you and Jack still a thing? Or like, do you want to get back together? And I was just like, no, I think I'll still be romancing Jack. And then the game's just kind of like, cool, done, moving on.
Yeah, so all of the characters, because I romanced Liara in the first one for this character and Garrus in the second one, and both of them had that conversation of, look, shit's heavy. Are we still doing this or are we not? And so you talk about that. I romanced Trainer in this one, the signal analyst we were talking about before, and it kind of just happens very quickly. Most of the previous games, you spend the whole game talking to them, you build up a bit of a relationship, and then you start to do the flirty stuff, and the relationship culminates in a sex scene before the final mission of the game. And then you get an achievement.
Yeah, that's a problem.
In this, Trainer, you have a couple of chats with her, and then she's all like, hey, you want to play chess? I love chess. And she comes up to your cabin to play chess, and then you can have sex if you want. And this is like 40% of the way through the game, and then that starts the relationship, which is marginally less problematic than, oh, I'm going to choose all the right options and then get sex. Like, the fact that sex itself is not the reward is better, but it also, like, there are points later on where Trainer's like, oh, I love you. And I'm like, do you? Because I feel like we fucked in a shower once. Like, don't get me wrong, I value you, but maybe we'll see how it pans out after the war.
David's awkward babbling about relationships aside, I think the developers of the game, they were trying to work around the idea, and they were like, with character interactions with people, let's just give them an interesting story and you just opt in.
Yeah. Right?
And then we'll tell the rest of the story. And I think it pays better for that because of all the
stuff
done to smooth out the dialogue and interact with characters. But, you know, you just sort of go into the room, you start talking and stuff like that. Makes it feel way more natural. And also, as much as we wish Mass Effect isn't a romance novel game, like a visual novel, although I would probably kickstart one, like, right? It's just like, if you're not 100% sure, just make it simple for people to engage with the story and move through that way.
And I think that if there's one thing I can say that is a positive, it's that the approach towards romance isn't as big a deal in a good way. Like in Mass Effect 1, especially when you're romancing Liara, she's got this whole like virginal sort of thing, and she's so like tortured about whether or not she should fall in love with you and that kind of thing.
That
and
was weirdly uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's weirdly uncomfortable, right? Because it's all about like, yeah, I'll show you the ways of love. I just think that having a more casual approach to it, that, yeah, sex and romance are normal things that are not really that big a deal, is a healthier attitude towards that in game.
Look, characters can have their own sort of things, but I did like in the original Mass Effect, you could go to Liara and Ashley and be like, hey, like, you can just both date me. Like,
Oh, really? You can do that?
There's a scene in Mass Effect 1 where they both confront you and they're like, which one are you going to choose? And you can kind of be like, do I have to choose? Like, can we do both?
Yeah.
And Ashley's like, no. And Liara's like, I don't mind. When Liara came up, she's like, do you still have feelings for me? I'm like, oh, yeah, totally, Liara, yeah. I do. But I also have feelings for Jack. This might be my polyamory showing, but I just wish there was more polyamorous options in relationships in video games.
I definitely do as well. I think that any kind of representation is great. I think this also does fit very well into another example of a thing that you don't like that is probably due to resource constraints. Yes. It is literally exponentially harder to do that than have monogamous relationship options in a game.
And they also have opened up the sort of sexuality spectrum of all the characters.
Yeah,
as well.
Which I really appreciate. Some characters that were in previous games have a more varied sexuality now. Like Caden, for example, if you've got him, is bi instead of straight, as he was in Mass Effect 1.
Is James a gay character?
No, James is straight.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure James is straight. Cortez is...
That explains why you didn't hit on me the whole time. I was waiting for it.
He does fun flirting, like teasing with both genders of Shepard that you can play, and you can call him on it and kind of push, and he retreats very quickly. But I think that with your female Shepard, you can coax him out into it. Cortez and Trainer are both exclusively gay. Tali and Garrus are both exclusively straight, and Liara is still bi.
Yeah, you're a real mix there.
Yeah, am I forgetting anyone?
Oh, that's of like that's. There's more options.
Yeah, if you get DLC, you can romance like Javik and shit, but you can't in the core game.
I already feel weird talking about people's sexual preferences. Yeah, it's nice as a variety. We don't need to list them all down.
Well, sometimes I think that the audience might be interested in that, but I might cut it. Whatever.
I wonder if a game could do some asexual characters in the future.
Well, I think we've talked about the talk David Gator gave at PAX. Yeah. He mentioned that ace characters are hard to do because it's difficult to non-explicitly address asexuality in a game, and that's not a delicate way to handle any kind of thing. So if you have to have a conversation where somebody's like, oh yeah, I'm non-binary, this is what being non-binary is like, that's not an elegant way to handle that conversation.
Not really.
It's better to introduce the person as a character and have that be a part of who that character is. For asexuality, and I say this as someone who is asexual to some degree, it is defined by a lack of action to some extent, right? I know that's an oversimplified way of phrasing it, but because it is more defined by what you aren't interested in and what you don't do than what you are interested in and what you do, it's hard to express asexuality in a subtle and respectful way. It kind of can only be addressed via conversation, which has its own problems.
Especially when, you know, the game has a kind of very simplistic view on how it structures these relationships.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the truth is, I mean, Morden's probably asexual.
Potentially, yeah. Then it's...
I read Morden as asexual.
Yeah. He's such a great character. I think another thing, too, when I was playing through Mass Effect 3, I feel like everyone just turns in a stellar performance. Even the voice of male Shep is still fun to play as.
Yeah.
Like, I think in Mass Effect 1, I was kind of like, oh, he's a bit bland. In this one, totally fine with it, totally on board.
Yeah.
I feel like really hit the stride, and there's not a single moment where I felt left out or that someone wasn't committing, you know?
I will say that female Shepard, Jennifer Hale, is the better Shepard. Having now played it through, her expression and her delivery is just much better and much more consistent, I think, than the male Shepard voice. It's still good. I don't want to knock it, but he is defined almost by being a brown-haired soldier man.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why he was cast. Canadian, though, so, I mean, there's that.
The only other sort of narrative thing was the characters you encounter that are just body doubles for characters that might not exist.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up.
So in previous games of Mass Effect, characters can die. Like, there's a suicide mission. I don't know if you heard about it.
You also can just choose to shoot some of them yourself.
Yeah, Mass Effect 1 and choosing to shoot Rex, I'm pretty sure is an option you can just have.
Yeah, you can have Ashley do it if you want.
Yeah, there's multiple... Now I think about it, there's multiple opportunities you can get to shoot Rex.
Yeah.
But there's some characters. I think Maudlin was another one that might not be there. And there's a moment where you go to do all the genophage stuff, and there's a scientist there who's basically like a home brand version of him.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I think the genophage is kind of a bad thing, and I'm glad we're doing something about it. And I'm kind of on that team.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you're just a replacement, are you?
Yeah, you're just here to fill this plot hole.
And when I looked into it, they even have a replacement for Legion that comes in as well. Yeah. And it stood out to me because I had all the characters and there would just be a double. There would just be someone there who kind of was filling that role most of the time.
Some of them are more elegant than others. Reeve takes the place of Rex. We've been introduced to him, I think, in Mass Effect 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Zan takes the place of Tali if she died and you meet her. She plays a pretty big role in Mass Effect 2. Yeah.
They do it better in some instances than in others.
Yeah, but Legion is just replaced by someone else.
And as I was reading the wiki, he has the exact same number of geth. It's so randomly specific. It was just like, I guess you're kind of winking at it there. But yeah, it just felt really noticeable. You're just not here for any reason. But well.
So not only is there elements of that where you get these less fully developed characters just slotted into the spot, there are also certain cutscenes you can kind of tell the developers didn't really expect most players to go with. So here's a big spoiler. When it comes to curing the genophage, you basically have two options: to either genuinely cure it or pretend to cure it just to get the Krogan on side.
Yeah.
And that's a big decision. We'll talk about that later. But if you choose that one, like in this game I did, Rex finds out and he tries to kill you because you betrayed him.
Mm-hmm.
And that cutscene that plays out there, there's not really any music under it. The dialogue is fine, but the blocking is clearly kind of rushed. Like, suddenly someone's in a totally different spot than where they were in the previous cut. Stuff like that.
And it stands out because I felt a lot of the cutscenes in this game were genuinely affecting.
Yeah, really good. The main plot ones are amazingly good.
There's a freaking dream sequence in this game that I found to be muy excellent.
Which ones? Are these the ones with the forest?
My favorite. Yeah, the forest dream sequence. It's like classic dream sequence. You're in a forest. There's moody music. A small child is running away.
Yeah.
You're moving in slow motion.
So right at the start of the game when the Earth is attacked, there's a point where you're trying to escape with Anderson, trying to get off planet.
Yeah.
And there's a small child who you find cowering in a vent. Mm-hmm. And you go to the child, come on, we have to go. And you try to get this, but they just run and disappear down this vent. And you can't follow because you can't
see. They say something vaguely ominous that made me feel like they were some sort of hallucination.
Yeah.
Turns out they were a real child.
Yeah. But after some major plot missions, you get these little dream sequences where you're trying to chase this child down, and they all end with this child catching fire while staring at you scarily. So there's a couple of reasons why these appear. I think they work in some ways and don't in others. One of the big ones is, like we were saying before, this game focuses a lot more on the emotional toll of being in this leadership position at a time of crisis.
Yeah.
And this is a manifestation of that. This is Shepard experiencing...
He's having stress-related dreams.
Yeah, or she.
Or she. Sorry. It's because I played through his... Yeah. Anyway, they are having stress-related dreams. And I found that really interesting because it doesn't feel like something that happens that common. Metal Gear Solid, you get a couple in some of the games. There'll be weird dream sequences.
Yeah.
Basically mini games. But in this, it's a full part of the narrative that's woven in.
Yeah, and it lends a lot more weight to these conversations where characters ask, how are you doing? And that's another thing I really appreciate about this one more than others is in most games, you as Shepard are talking to other people and performing emotional labor for them. In this game, other characters make an effort to check in on you and ask how you are doing. And I like that because it feels like there's a greater sense of closeness there. And you have the options of pretending everything is fine because you need to appear strong and be a strong leader to these people, or relying on the people around you and being honest. And it gives it a lot more weight when you know that Shepard is pretending to be strong rather than them just not actually being affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
It is another one of these examples, like you say, of some things that you don't get to choose about Shepard. Shepard is stressed out by the situation. You don't get to make a decision that they're not. But it does lend more weight to your interactions with other characters about that.
And I feel like that allows you to tell a very strong narrative that I think Mass Effect does pull off while allowing players to have narrative freedom and influence over the game. And to me, it's like the sweet spot if you don't want to go in for full dynamic storytelling.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, it works in some ways, it doesn't in others. I found it a little bit lame the first time I saw it. I thought it was a bit cliched. But the more I saw it, the more I realized it was doing this thing to characterize Shepard, and it wasn't just some...
I think the reason is, when I approach these games, I don't think of myself as Shepard. I am playing Shepard.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I should have... Because if I was being Shepard and choosing all of his actions, the game would play differently. I think that would be the truth.
Yeah, if I was Shepard, I would have had a breakdown the first 5 minutes in and then just spent the rest of the game eating too much ice cream.
I'd just be manic and then collapse in a pile halfway through the story. But when I came to the game with that kind of, you know, Shepard is a person who is either good or bad, and you can sort of vary the degrees to which they are.
Yeah, I think that if you accept... If you think about your decisions as being a collaborative part of the story rather than you being completely in control of Shepard because Shepard belongs to you, you'll have a better experience with any of the games in the series, and also probably a better experience of the ending, which we will talk about soon. We promise.
We're almost there. We're right on the cusp. The temperature is rising in this room. The oxygen is leaving us. We will soon get to it.
So I did want to take a little bit of a moment to talk about some of the bigger choices.
Yep.
So, John, I've obviously played this twice. I've done it once Renegade, once Paragon, so I've made a lot more variance in my choices than you. So why don't you tell me, with the Genophage, what did you decide to do?
I'm a very good Shepard, so I just did the very good thing. I was like, let's stop all the child deaths, please.
Yeah, let's maybe not commit genocide on these people.
Also, the really fucked up thing to me about the Genophage is it doesn't make them completely infertile. It reduces the success rate.
Yeah, right? It's also the most viscerally upsetting way you could do it. It isn't a lower fertility rate. Yeah. It's a higher miscarriage rate.
Yeah, which is dark and just sad.
Yeah.
And also,
quick interruption here, though. Miscarriages are a natural part of life. Most women have at least one before they have their first child. We demonize that a lot in the way we talk about it in culture. But it is probably, even acknowledging that, the least cool way to implement this genocide weapon.
Did you have to use the word cool there, David?
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
Like, I do, yeah. It is upsetting. And while I understand, it's so interesting to have the Salarians, the super smart ones, be what I feel to be super misguided, you know, so backwards in their thinking.
They're so cynical about it.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, you know, the game really balances out. You know, you see what Krogan culture kind of was like with the idea of them building giant cities and like having a culture.
Yeah, and you actually, there's a point where you get lost in some Krogan ruins and you look at some of their lore and their history and their culture.
I think there's a part where it's like, Krogan's painted? What?
Yeah.
And it's just like, who knows what they'll be? Let's give them a shot.
Yeah.
And so that's what I chose, because I can't... The other option that the game gives you is to pretend that it went through. And I'm never doing that.
Yeah. See, I was talking before about how the game examines a lot of different themes at different points. Sometimes that muddies decisions. So in this point, you've got, like I was talking about before, there are issues about gender and there's issues about genocide and that kind of thing. But there are also questions about overpopulation. So you've got this question... Do we keep this society in a state of subsistence for the safety of us, the more powerful race? That's a fucked up, dark, colonial question to ask, and I think there's a very obvious answer to that question. No, don't do that.
No,
that's
do
shitty.
Sounds
don't
like
do that. That's really fucked up.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you have this question about overpopulation, and that's a question that we as humans should be asking about ourselves as well. There are 7 billion people on this planet, and some estimates I've read say that it can only reasonably support about 1 billion people at a standard of living that we would find acceptable. Mm-hmm. There are elements of myth and stuff in that. For example, if everybody was vegan, the number would be much higher than if people eat meat, but we're getting sort of sidetracked here. The point is, we at some point will probably need to ask the question about how we maintain a sustainable population level on this planet. The Krogan, I used as a way to examine both of these conversations, and both of them complicate the other.
Yeah.
Because in isolation, any of these questions are quite simple. Well, yes, overpopulation is bad.
Yes.
We need to think about how we address that.
Also, sterilizing a race of people is bad.
Also, sterilizing a race of people is bad. Also, colonialism is bad.
Yeah.
Also, what this does to the women of this society is bad. And
that's a very
all that kind of thing.
Important point to raise as well.
And then you've also got the question that I almost forgot when I was playing this game, and that's that the Salarians won't join your army if you cure the Genophage. So do you forsake their support in saving Earth, which is another question that complicates the themes here and doesn't make these decisions quite as clear. When it comes to a game like Mass Effect, I admire its complexity, and I don't want to necessarily say this is too complex and it makes these themes harder to understand and people will make a decision based on one thing.
Because I think people do that in real life all the time. People make decisions over a small factor of any question. So
yeah, and what I'm trying to get at here is that I like that the game is complicated, and I like that it takes time to examine themes that aren't necessarily the main questions of the game.
And then to complicate them.
Yeah, but I also think that having these questions, where there ultimately is a right and a wrong answer for some of these questions, like you said, genocide is wrong, colonialism is bad, but muddying that with questions that are more complex, like population control and that kind of thing, and the fact that the Krogan, when you're talking to Rex about curing the Genophage, one of the things that he's excited about is being able to spread to new worlds and expand a Krogan empire. And So now it's like, well, am I empowering people that actually are going to be violent? So it makes for some good narrative complexity, but that can inhibit the message, the message I would consider to be healthier and better for society to absorb, which is things like genocide wrong, colonialism bad, you know?
Yeah. I think in a game, being able to explore the outcomes should be an important part about making decisions, right?
So, remind me that you said that, because we're going to talk about that as well.
yep, we are. And so not only does the game present you a choice where you could make what we could call the morally wrong one, but it shows you the consequences of that.
Yeah.
Right? It tells you what happens to the people. A dude shows up to kill you because of it. Right?
Yeah. Now, in this playthrough, I chose to not cure the Genophage.
Yep. Because you're a monster?
Because I'm a monster. The main reason was because Rex kept talking about wanting to take over other planets. And I'm like, oh, no.
Yes.
No.
He does do that quite a bit.
They really, really, really make you feel it. And I think that that is another thing that this game does beyond the other ones. If you don't get the magical good third option ending, they make you feel the tragedy and the consequences of your actions. In this one, Morden finds out that you're planning on faking the cure, and he insists that he's still going to do it because he regrets it.
I read this online.
And you have to kill him.
You just got to gun him down.
Yeah, and it's brutal. It is brutal. And I was talking before about how I felt some level of anxiety about some of the decisions that I made. Like, even though I knew this wasn't the real choice I would make here, I was making this decision to see new content, basically, I hated myself after I did it. Even then, I was like, should I load a save and just, I've seen it now, should I load a save and do the other one? It was rough.
And can't all the games be Undertale and make you feel that decision was forever?
Yeah. I mean, the Geth and the Quarians is another one of this where they're at war in this one. And unless you do a lot of stuff right, and when I say a lot of stuff right, I'm talking over the three games. Yes. There is a lot of things you need to do right to endear yourself and earn the goodwill from both of these factions to actually convince them to lay down arms.
Things I did.
Yes, thankfully. If you don't do a lot of that stuff right, you decide who wins the war.
Yep.
And the other side is
wiped out.
Yeah. And again, they fucking make you feel it one way or the other.
Do you know what happens if you side with the Geth?
Yep.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
Basically, all the Quarians are wiped out. It's just terrible.
No, it's really, really rough.
Yeah, it's so dark, I don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, neither do I. But I just wanted to bring these up because, like I said, they really lean on the heavy thing of it. And one of the big criticisms about Mass Effect 3 generally, but specifically again the ending, was that the ending wasn't heroic enough and it didn't feel like Mass Effect because you weren't successful. I think the whole game works harder to be darker, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing because it isn't just grimdark for the sake of grimdark.
Let's talk about this fucking ending, right?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, because saying you're not being heroic, I don't know about you, but I felt fucking heroic when I made all the fucking Reapers stop killing everybody and fix everything.
So you did control?
Yeah, you got me.
Yeah, right? Okay. So for those of you who don't know, there are three main endings. You don't necessarily unlock. There is a fourth option that's a little bit less obvious, but it is an option. So Let's talk about the endings as they stand now, and then I'll talk about what they used to be. And because I'm very curious if you think that some of the improvements were better or worse, because you only know the current ones.
So you've got three options, basically.
Yep. And I'm going to talk about them in the difficulty to achieve from a war readiness level, because the more readiness you have, you unlock further ones up. Lowest one, as it stands for this one, is Reapers keep doing what they're doing. Now, that might be because you fail to stop them or because you don't have a good enough army, but I'm pretty sure that might be mechanically impossible.
Yeah.
Or you choose that that happens. So actually, we'll take a step back. The end of the game has you unlock this super weapon that can affect every Reaper in the galaxy.
Yep.
You board this super weapon, you're about to set it off, and you speak with basically an AI that is the collective consciousness of the Reapers. It's that takes the body of that little kid we were talking about before.
Yeah.
It's, again, it's a little bit cliched, but basically it is, you are talking to the Reapers as a whole when you're talking to this holographic child.
That's where you learn all about the forebearers to everything as well.
Yeah, so there's...
God, this game has
so
much history.
Yeah, before this point, why the Reapers are doing what they're doing is a complete mystery. So it's until the last, like, 15 minutes of the game,
you have
a vague idea.
You basically think that this is how they kind of reproduce. They come, they take the dominant species, they make a new Reaper of it, and they just do it all again to harvest.
And there's some stuff about, like, order and chaos that you hear a couple of times.
It's very, still mysterious.
So you meet this kid, and they explain that the reason for their being is that organics eventually reach a point of sentience where they create synthetic life. They create artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Artificial intelligence, by its design, will always want to improve itself to the point that it outstrips organic life. And at that point, there can only be conflict.
Quarians and Geths, anyone?
Yeah. And this system of cycles is designed to cull organic life at the point where it's pretty much creating synthetic life. It culls all advanced life, leaves any pre-industrial society as is, and then allows the cycle to continue anew, because they believe that the conflict between synthetics and organics will ultimately lead to the entire eradication of all organic life on every level.
Yeah, and so, across the whole galaxy.
Yeah, and so basically, it's a cull. It is a cull designed to preserve the concept of organic life.
It is set to trigger once the race is advanced enough to reach the Citadel, and then a timer's basically set, and then they get culled.
So, got a question for you.
Yes.
Before we talk about the different options, how do you feel about that as the motivation for the Reapers?
I mean, to me, that feels like a perfect motivation for a giant unknowable evil to just come in. It makes sense on a logical level that a civilization could come to this outcome, and there's a tragedy in the idea of it, because the race that sort of tried to set this up got wiped out itself.
By the Reapers.
By the Reapers.
Yeah.
So there's kind of like the idea of how dark and sad that is, that all of this that got put into place, it also didn't help the people who put it in place.
Yeah.
It helps no one. It is just this perpetual, almost misery of pain and death.
See, I agree. I think that it works. It's not necessarily fantastic. Like, there could have been... Just as a random example, if this was a way to curtail universal entropy, for example, some people might have felt that was more compelling, that, like, we need to make sure life doesn't get past a particular point, otherwise they're just going to consume everything everywhere. But it's a similar kind of idea, you know? It's sort of about, like, this is the way we preserve things. And they make it very clear that when they harvest an organic civilization, that is used as the basis for constructing a Reaper, and Reapers are sort of hybrid organic synthetic life forms.
Yep.
And that is a way to preserve life in the best way they can think to do it, and still prevent life from getting to a point where all life in the galaxy is going to be wiped out.
Yep.
And so it kind of works. I think that a very important thing to note, though, the dialogue of this sequence was rewritten to make that clearer.
Okay, cool.
A lot of people didn't like the ending here because they basically heard, hang on, you want to stop us getting killed by robots, so you built a super army of super robots to kill us. That's what a lot of people took from that.
Yeah, of course.
I, at that first point, the first design of that ending, I understood this.
Yeah.
But they've rewritten this to make it much clearer, which I think is an improvement.
That's what I thought. That's what I was thinking when that happened. I was there like, okay, cool. You guys kind of made a boo-boo. And then, yeah, I just made my choice. So, so yeah, the first option is to sort of...
The first option is, you know what? That sounds pretty good. Keep doing that. Bye. And then you walk off and you let the Reavers keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Second option is do what you were thinking you were going to do the whole time, which is destroy the Reapers. Yep. You shoot a thing, it blows up.
Push the button, a big red light goes
out. All the Reapers die.
Yep.
Option three is what you chose, which is control. So the elusive man this whole game has been convinced that he can actually use this super weapon, the Crucible, as it's called, to not destroy the Reapers, but control them and then harness their power and use that to vault humanity to its next stage of evolution. If you want, you can do that. So Shepard is destroyed, amalgamated into this machine consciousness, basically replaces this holographic boy as the collective consciousness of the Reapers and uses them to basically keep order. And the way that cutscene sort of plays out is this idea that, okay, the whole synthetic organic conflict is now over because this even more powerful group is preventing it from occurring.
Yeah.
Very kind of authoritarian.
Yeah. When I played through, those were the only options available to me because I might have rushed the ending.
Oh, so you didn't get the third one?
Yes.
So the third one is Synthesis, which is presented as the best ending, not just from the context of the game, but also from this holographic character says, this is what I want you to do.
Yeah, overtly says it.
Yeah, and this is where basically you once again disseminate Shepard into the Crucible, but Shepard's DNA is used to form a new basis of life where basically all synthetic life gains organic traits, all organic life gains synthetic traits.
Yeah.
And the kid basically says, this is the final evolution of all life. Synthetics will gain the true understanding they desire of organics. Yeah. Organics will gain perfection through technology.
And as I look at my control option more and more, I kind of feel like I probably should have done that one if I could. Yeah.
Synthesis.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
I despise Synthesis. I think it's a terrible option.
Yeah.
Well, both in this one and in the original construction of the ending, it is such a fundamentally huge, unpredictable change that it is scarier to me than the extinction of all sentient life in the galaxy.
Okay. Wow.
Right? I mean, think about that, right? Like, there's so many elements of it. So first up, the bad guy wants me to do it. Let's start there. Not a great thumbs up.
Sure, but I don't. Yeah, okay.
You're right. This isn't Black Panther. This bad guy is not speaking sense. So we'll put that to the side for the moment, but basically, and even Shepard says this in the rewritten version of the ending, that's a huge change. I don't know if I should be the person to make this decision. There's a logical point of conflict for me as well with that one, because they're basically saying, oh, all conflict will end because all life will be the same. Humans exist on this planet. We're all pretty much the same. We find plenty of reasons to fight each other and do horrible things to each other. I don't think that, our DNA is pretty similar, we'll stop any kind of conflict between synthetic and organic life.
That hasn't worked yet.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of things like that that...
Sure, but when you put those options between making a super god to control the universe or explosions, that's why I'm leaning more towards the Synthesis one.
The real choice of both of my characters is destroy. That's what we're here for. This force is... I don't like to use words like unnatural, but the Reapers are a construct that was designed for destruction. They are not a good thing, and the universe will not miss them when they're gone. Now, I understand completely wiping out a form of life is pretty rough.
Yeah, yeah. I'm giving you eyes right now.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, but it's... I don't know if it's appropriate for me to make this.
Can we make these moral judgments?
No, I was going to say, I don't know if this is an appropriate comparison. You know the tolerance paradox?
I don't know.
Okay, so the tolerance paradox is basically, if you have a society that's entirely tolerant, it needs to be tolerant to intolerant views, and therefore is no longer an entirely tolerant society.
Yeah.
For a truly tolerant and understanding and safe society for a diverse number of people, some things do in fact need to be excluded. In this example, the form of life that we are eradicating is a form of life that eradicates other forms of life. And so while it's very, like I said, it's very dark to completely eliminate a species of sentient creatures, they are clearly centrally bound by this one ideology. So I don't know how truly sentient they are. And secondly, we eradicate diseases all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But diseases aren't things that we can engage with. Yeah. Right? They are like typically microscopic, and as far as we know, don't make good movies, right? You know, I'm sure if germs and bacteria and disease had some sort of tangible good as well as the very tangible bad they produce,
yeah,
it might be a different story. And I just feel when there's a giant sort of unknowable race of beings, if we could merge all together so we could have some sort of interesting understanding, something new and dynamic,
here's a question, a philosophical question about death and destruction.
Okay.
Right. I am not the kind of person, I'm not a conservative person. I believe that positive change is a real thing. Change is generally good if we're careful about how we implement it. And yep. I want us to move forward, and I want us to evolve as a species, and yes. I want us to evolve as a culture. That said, we do need to ask ourselves the question, at what point is meaningful change destruction? So at what point does change become so severe that it is effectively destruction of the old? When we think about things like colonialism, for example, we were all about going to places, quote unquote, improving other cultures and eliminating people of particular racial and ethnic groups, or eliminating people of particular cultural groups, sometimes through things like education and things that we don't typically think of as violence, but are a very real kind of social and cultural violence.
Yeah, sure. But there's a context to which those things were implemented that should be considered.
But what we're talking about in this situation, I'm just talking about my thinking here, yep. right? I, as an individual, have been presented yep. with a decision. I cannot confer with the galactic community about this. We can't take a vote on this.
Yep.
I just have to make the choice.
Cool.
Do I fundamentally and irreversibly transform all life in this galaxy into something entirely different? Do I have the right to make that decision?
Ah, that's the argument you have.
And this is, so my argument is, basically, to me, synthesis is the destruction of all existing life in the galaxy, right down to microscopic organisms.
Yeah, and also it also removes the consent of the entire galaxy.
Yes, whereas destruction is the elimination of all synthetic life in the galaxy, which, again, I really like the Geth, that fucking sucks. But I made the decision on my very first playthrough in this game. I said to myself, if it comes down to me choosing between humanity and every other species in the galaxy, I will choose every other species in the galaxy. Because I thought that's what they were going to do. They were going to be like, you can save humanity or you can save everyone else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which sounds like a real Mass Effect style choice to make. And so the choice they offered me is you can save
organic or synthetic.
Or you to save the rest of the galaxy in their current state, you destroy the Geth and the Reapers. And I was like, well, I mean, that hurts too, but I already said I would not choose one race over the collective races. The other thing that I think is very important about these decisions too.
Wait, you're not considering the Geth a race?
I mean, that might have been an error of how I spoke. What did I say?
So you said that you didn't want to choose one race over another.
Yeah.
Right?
No. I didn't want to choose one at the expense of all others.
Right.
So I was willing to sacrifice any single race if it meant the rest of the galaxy would be safe. Because that's cold, but I don't...
Yeah, rough to be the Geth. Yeah, yeah. No. I understand the logic behind your idea. That I can understand that.
Now, there is one other thing that I didn't bring up, and I think that this affects my thinking a lot when I made these decisions. The elusive man thought he could control the Reapers.
Mm.
He couldn't. He was indoctrinated. He was manipulated by them. The whole time I was up on that platform, I was asking myself, is this character lying to me?
Oh, yeah.
Is synthesis a lie? Is control a lie? Is destruction a lie? Can I trust what this character says? And that's, again, why I went with destruction. Now, I think that a really big part of this as well, I was talking about how synthesis is what the Reaper character wants. Control is what the elusive man wanted. And destruction is what Anderson wanted. They're sort of the characters that sort of embody each of those decisions.
Okay.
Of those three characters, who is the most reasonable?
Well, I mean, Anderson.
Yeah,
I
guess. He's the least douchebaggy, right?
Out of the options, yeah, I really can't stand the elusive man on any level.
Keith David.
Yeah, no, that's true, right? But I guess you could consider me selfish to forcefully evolve the entire galaxy, or at least take a gamble on that.
Mm.
Apparently, I would roll those dice. I think it's fundamentally true to say that like it's ruining everyone's agency from that decision.
Yeah,
but also. all agencies removed from that decision entirely.
Well, the destroy is what everybody thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
I've got everybody's votes on at least that one.
Sure. Sure, sure, sure.
So let's talk about some of the differences between this and the old one. So
Right, this happened. Got no problem with it.
Yeah.
Right? The story culminates in this big battle, and then you go there and you do a bit of a fight because you're wounded, and then you make a decision and the game is over.
Yeah, and this whole scene, there's a bit of a confrontation with the elusive man just before you make this big decision with the Reapers, and you. One of the things I really like about that is the fact that the final confrontation in the game is a conversation. It's not a big boss fight, which I think is a good thumbs up about what the priorities were for this game.
Even in a game that has such a great combat.
Yeah, yeah. And so all of this works really well. So I already mentioned that one of the differences is that the choices and options are better explained in the rewrite.
Good.
One of the other things is that in the initial way the ending was phrased, they said that using the Crucible would destroy the Mass Effect relays. No matter what your choice was, all the Mass Effect relays would be destroyed.
Oh.
And so for a lot of people, that was like, we're going to destroy galactic civilization no matter what we choose, right? Yeah. And so a lot of people felt that was bad. But in this, they say there will be destruction, but you'll be able to fix it. So it still happens. You still see the relays get destroyed, but you also generally see people addressing that problem and repairing them or something
because when I chose control, for example, the Reapers were all putting them back together.
Yeah, so the previous ending, you got the flash of light that was whatever color you chose. Red for destroy, blue for control, green for synthesis. The cutscene happens up to the point where the Normandy gets hit by the wave and crashes, and they come out of the ship, they look at the fancy planet, game ends. So you don't get that following cutscene where Shepard talks through their decisions. You don't get the slideshow that shows the effects of some of the earlier decisions you made in the game. And you don't see the Normandy get repaired and fly away. So it ends in this really weird kind of downer note where, okay, is my crew just stranded on some alien planet forever now?
Mass Effect 4. Stranded on a space planet.
And so it wasn't super well explored from that point. Something else that they change is, you know, when you're running towards the beam,
yeah,
and there's a point where one of your crew gets hit and the Normandy flies down and you put your crew on there and they fly away. Doesn't happen.
Oh,
right. So what used to happen was you were just running at the beam, then the big one comes across and you hear someone say over the radio, they're all dead, they were all destroyed, and you think that your whole crew's been wiped out, but they obviously weren't, because you see them later in cutscenes. Wow. So people are like, wait, how the fuck did that happen?
Yeah.
What was Joker doing? Was Joker fleeing the battle? And so they explain a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So some of that is better. Some of that is clunkier. But the big difference, I think, is that they show that final monologue over the slideshow. And so if you save
all that style.
Yeah, and if you cured the Genophage, you see the Krogan rebuilding. If you didn't cure it, you see the Krogan languishing in squalor for the rest of their existence and stuff like that.
Cool. So that ending does sound bad, the one you described.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit rough.
Mm.
And it sounds like going to do a rewrite and putting in some slideshows was a nice touch, made it a bit clearer.
I think on the whole it's improved. I think that one of the big things that made people dislike the old ending, like I said, was confusion.
Yeah.
So they make it much clearer what the purpose of the Reapers is in this one, and they talk a bit more about the history of the Reapers, their initial creation in this ending, whereas in the previous ending, like I said, a lot of people walked away from that hearing, wait, you didn't like that organics were being killed by synthetics, so you created a whole bunch of synthetics to kill organics.
Because I could see why people would be very confused by that.
Yeah.
Because that sounds very weird. And as it did kind of happen, you kind of need to explain that, no, they were doing a thing and then it backfired.
Yeah, they made some dudes, then this AI was created, then this AI went rogue, and they make it much clearer as well in this ending that like you as Shepard can actually say things like, your solution is flawed. What you believe to be the only option doesn't make sense. And so they made it clearer that this wasn't a problem with the writing. The character does not think very creatively.
Yeah. It's a limitation of that AI.
Yeah, like
its solution is
morbid. Its solution is not great.
Yeah, yeah. That's what you call a patch, really. That's the duct tape of all intergalactic solutions.
Yeah,
annihilating species after species.
It's not great. And I think that another big thing they do as well in this new ending is that they don't present synthesis as so heavily weighted as the best ending.
Yeah,
they make it clear that the AI thinks it's the best ending, but like it isn't level 1, level 2, level 3, good, better, best, you know? And I think that that's a better way to do that.
Yeah, I think all the options are different. Depends on your perspective of things. I chose control because I thought that was a better option than blowing everything up.
Yeah, and I can understand why. Control is the second worst option for me.
Yeah, right. But if I had the option to merge organic and synthetic life, I probably would have chosen that one because I would have rolled those dice on whatever weird cyberpunk things we would do.
Nope.
That's because I feel afraid of it, but I feel like my fear is misguided.
I think that, like I was saying before, change, you need to be considerate about how change is implemented, and not only is it just a huge roll of the dice making a decision on behalf of everybody else, all that kind of thing. I also felt like control was a huge roll of the dice. What if that was a fucking lie? What if by assimilating into this thing, they changed me more than I changed them? The only reason that destruction was hard was because the Geth die and Edie dies, and Edie is one of the better characters in Mass Effect
3. Oh, yeah, that's true. No, Lane. No, everyone lives and we're all computer people. Thank you. That's my option. Yeah. But, I guess what option you choose comes down to what you think. But because the version I played is better explained, I just felt it was fine.
Yeah, and I mean, completely agree.
Endings are always kind of like a bummer, especially this. Like, I had so much fun with the Mass Effect and playing, and I kind of don't really want to go back to it too much. You know, I will probably play more of 3 to explore some of the side missions that I didn't get a chance because I rushed it to do this, as I previously mentioned, finishing it today. But I don't, you know, it's kind of done. Like, I played it, it's sort of done, and that's a bummer. But I don't know, it felt fine.
Yeah, and I think that I'm reminded of the episode we did on Journey, and you mentioned that you'd heard from at least one, maybe a couple of people, that the game left them feeling sad. Sure. And I think that this ending is always going to be bittersweet in the same way that reaching the last page of any good book is kind of sad. When you finish Harry Potter, if you love Harry Potter and you finish it, like the first time you've read the last book or watched the last movie and you had that moment of, this thing that I love and I've been invested in for years is finished now.
Yep.
And that is hard when we're really attached to the art that we like.
Yeah, and especially seeing Andromeda, we know that it's finished for real.
But I think even if this ending was perfect and it was like the best ending you could possibly have made, people would still feel this way.
Yeah, it would still have that weight.
I think so much about the really big criticism that I saw keep popping up about why the ending was bad. It's like you don't feel heroic enough. And not only is that kind of juvenile for a lot of reasons, I don't feel empowered and awesome enough. I don't feel like my dick was big enough at the end of this game.
I did fucking die. Like, yeah. You're pretty heroic.
I didn't, motherfucker. Destruction is the only one where Shepard doesn't die. So yeah, even though that whole, it wasn't heroic enough was, you know, crappy for a whole bunch of just like, not every story you hear has to be heroic kind of perspective.
Sometimes endings are sad.
Yeah.
Sometimes people don't win.
I think that a lot of that might have been people just confused about the sadness of ending any good story. And I don't want to belittle people's opinions, but I also think that, like I said, even with the poorer explanation, when I finished the game the first time, I don't want to get too elitist about this, but I felt like I got it, and most people who didn't like the ending just kind of didn't really understand what the ending was doing. And I feel less elitist saying that now after I've seen the more thorough explanation that kind of shows my read on it was a lot more accurate than others were.
You know what the problem with a 40-hour game is?
Yeah.
You can't just replay it on a whim. It's not like if you watched Inception once and you got confused and then you watched it again and you understood it a little bit better.
Yeah, and like the context of the ending makes more sense when you watch the stuff that came before it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can, and people have. How many times did you play Mass Effect 1, for example? Like a lot, right? Some games we just play a lot. The idea of like playing through the whole game and holding all those themes and then coming to that ending again and being like, oh, this kind of does feel kind of heroic.
Yeah.
That's a lot to ask someone.
Mm. They do also, like, on that very specific heroic thing, there are a couple of subtler changes. Like, the music is slightly different. When the Normandy gets caught with that wave in the original ending, it looked really destructive, and the music ended on this really weird, like, almost like horror sting as it happened. Whereas in this one, it looks a little bit less destructive, and the music swells with, like, brass and becomes very uplifting. And so a lot of tiny little things like that, I think, can really change the tone of an ending. So again, I don't want to shit on people for their opinions, but I always found that argument a little bit hollow.
You know what would be great is if anyone gets to this point and differs and disagrees, let us know. I would love
absolutely.
Now I think about it, I haven't actually talked to someone, apart from you, David, about this ending, because it's kind of moved on, and you only just hear people go, it was bad. I would like to know why people think it is.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I should clarify as well, I'm judging my opinion mainly on things like the petitions that were circulated about why the ending needed to be changed.
And let's be real, general, none of those petitions are well-worded.
Yeah, and not only are they not well-worded, but... For me to feel so, you know, for me to feel so owed by a developer and so owed by an artist to go out of my way to get grassroots support to make them change their art, I will never, ever, 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 ever have that much self-confidence or self-assurance about anything. Right? I will say to plenty of people, I don't like what you wrote, and I actually think that what you wrote is disgusting. I would never say to someone, you owe me a rewrite.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, that's so much, like, the difference there is...
And that comes, I think that comes into the way we engage with games, the way like, the community around games is built. The amount of time you invest in games...
Yeah.
Like, I've probably played 60 to 80 hours of Mass Effect. Probably over 100 by the time we're done with all the Mass Effect games.
It's
a long time to do anything. You can't help but get engaged with something when you're playing it more often. And that's only a single playthrough.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, I played much more than that.
Yeah, and you know, I think about some of the books that I've read, and some of the ones I've read heaps of times, and I can understand that attachment. But then that idea that...
Anyway. And you know, we're getting into stuff like parasocial relationships here and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think a phrase that, as a culture, we did not know at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot that we could say about that. But on the whole, I think that I feel very comfortable saying that the conversation around Mass Effect's ending does the game, the series, and the developers a huge disservice. I think that...
Particularly the game,
yeah. I think it also does the people who enjoy the game a disservice as well, because it's so easy for us to get caught up on specific things. And there's a lot of conversation about what things in a piece disqualify that from being quote-unquote good.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Right now we're having a lot more conversations, thankfully, about representation in art and positive messages in art and, you know, problematic messages in art. When we're talking about this, the ending of the game being the one thing you disqualify the entire game for, that actually is, I think, an incredibly limited view. Like, when we're talking about things like theme and message and problematic constructions of art, that's so much more full a criticism than the ending was a bit of a letdown, therefore this whole game is like a 4.5 out of 10.
I mean, Mass Effect 3 is such a solid game the whole way through. Like, you're discounting so much enjoyment and work and everything.
And I think part of the reason
I'm missing it that way.
Yeah, part of the reason I'm focusing on this is because when it came to replaying Mass Effect for the show, I wanted to do Mass Effect 1. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
Mass Effect 2, I enjoyed the idea of being able to talk about it with you, but I didn't feel like making you play two games was necessary. But you were the person who pushed for the whole series. And I was actually resistant to that. I was like, I don't know if we need to do the whole series. I don't know if I want to play Mass Effect 3 again because it was kind of a letdown and all this kind of thing. I am a victim of this thinking. Like, I remember liking Mass Effect 3 and liking the ending at the time, but even I had my memories of it colored by the conversation that happened around it. And I'm so, so glad that we replayed it for this show, because it's made me see it as it is, not as my, for want of a better term, accumulated prejudices made me kind of misremember it as. And so, like, I think of myself as a pretty good critical thinker most of the time, and I understand that this is Mass Effect, it's very trivial, it's not a big deal, but if I, with my perspective on art, could have been negatively affected by this conversation, I think that pretty much anybody who has played this game was probably affected negatively by that conversation. And that's a shame, because it's a game that's worth enjoying.
Yeah.
And it makes me kind of a little bit sad to think that people enjoyed it less because of internet petitions and Reddit and stuff like that. I think that it puts this game in a very unique perspective for the premise of our show, where our show is about examining not just the game, but the game...
In the context of having...
Of the conversation at the time, yeah. I mean, that's a big thing that we talk about a lot on this show. And I think this really highlights that this game is so different from what history remembers it as.
Yeah, I just can't dissuade the fact that for me personally, especially, these games feel like a ramp upwards.
Mm.
Right? They feel like they're growing and transcending. It makes me more interested to play Andromeda
yeah,
and see what that's like, because I'm just intrigued now.
It's so interesting that you say that, because the whole Andromeda was released really buggy. They had to rush to get bugs out to make people like it. It echoes the conversation about the ending of Mass Effect 3. Of course, the bugs apparently in Andromeda were significantly more fundamental.
And quite visual.
Yeah.
They made for a lot of YouTube videos.
But like you say, it does make me more optimistic to play the game. We've made the comment before. I doubt it's going to be as bad as everybody says, especially post these kind of patches.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will still be interested to see how much legitimacy there was to that conversation, especially to see how the quality of conversation about games generally has improved over the past 5 years. More people think more deeply about the art they consume in gaming now. And so it'll be interesting to see if these criticisms are legitimate or if they're a little bit more exaggerated like they were with Mass Effect 3. One thing that does make me feel all kinds of bittersweet sadness about going into Andromeda is that there's no imported save for Mass Effect 3. It's an entirely unrelated story to the point of ludicrousness. Do you know what the premise of Andromeda is?
Yeah, it's basically like this is set in a completely different galaxy over there.
Yeah, and see, I thought it was going to be like Star Trek Atlantis, where it's like, it's pretty hard to get there, but you can.
Yeah.
But this is like, no, we loaded everybody up in a ship, we sent them on a 600-year journey in cryosleep. When they wake up there, they are never coming back. And I'm like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. I just, like, it feels so separate and so...
Yeah, yeah. And I remember people criticizing that too, because, I mean, they did a lot of work to make you love all the characters and the world of Mass Effect. And like we said, it sucks to have to let characters go, especially ones you love and care about a lot.
Yeah. And that's hard. I would prefer for them to do it, but I honestly thought when they announced there was going to be a new Mass Effect, my first thought was, how do you do one after Mass Effect 3?
Yeah, and their solution was to launch it in a spaceship, cryogenically frozen, 600 years
away. The relevant timeline ends between 2 and 3, because that's when the ship was launched.
Yeah.
So you get Mass Effect 1 and 2. You don't import that, but that happened, then the ship is launched. But I was always like, I don't know, do a prequel, set it like during first contact or something like that. And then,
it would be very...
You'd still have like the galaxy we all know and love with totally new characters. Maybe like a young Anderson would be kind of fun.
Have an episodic series where you follow some historical events around or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of things.
You know, why don't we do a Turian focused one set 1,000 years before the humans even enter the galaxy?
That's a great point, David. All of these games are told from a human perspective.
Yeah.
It would be nice to play as a different race.
And so, look, we'll see how Andromeda is.
Species, sorry.
Yeah, a different species. Yeah. Yeah, we should be using the word species more.
Yeah, because you can play as a different race.
Look, that's all Andromeda. We'll see how that goes when we actually get to that next season.
And then we can stop playing Mass Effect.
Yeah, we can stop playing Mass Effect because there's not going to be any more of them.
Oh, unless we start playing some of the phone games.
Yeah, and start reading the tie-in novels.
We'll see how we go.
They're all about the origins of Kai Leng, the extra henchman.
Oh, yeah, he's very extra.
However, just so over the top, and I can't decide if I love it or hate it.
David, I am calling it. This is Mass Effect 3. I had a great time. I'm so glad I finished the trilogy.
Me too. I'm glad we came back to it. So if you like what we do, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at SlowpokesCast and Facebook at facebook.com/SlowpokesPodcast. As we mentioned, we did a bit of a Let's Play type thing for the multiplayer in Mass Effect 3. You can see that on our YouTube page.
Yep.
Just go to YouTube and search for us.
Put the links up on Facebook.
Absolutely. Probably in the description here as well. Our next game is the opposite of a year-spanning space opera trilogy. It is a small game by a small developer and one that I am also quite fond of. The next game, John, is Volume.
Yeah, Volume. It is another Mike Biffle game, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I'm very interested because it feels like a very different game. It's a stealth kind of roguelike?
So I don't know if it's a roguelike, but it's a stealth-focused game. Mm. It's Biffle's second commercial game. First was Thomas Was Alone, and third was Subsurface Circular. Subsurface Circular being by far his most successful game.
Yeah.
If you are interested in him, as his stuff usually is, it's pretty short, and I imagine pretty cheap, but I'd encourage you to play it along with us.
Definitely.
I have no idea if it's good or not.
Yeah.
I just think it, you know, judging by his other works, probably gonna be.
At the very least, you should check out Subsurface Circular. It's a wonderful time.
Yeah, 100%. So join us next time for Volume.
Yep.
I've been David.
I've been John.
Thanks for joining us for the Slowpokes.
And a galactic goodbye.